Captivating by John and Stacy Eldridge. This audio version is published by Oasis Audio through an agreement with Nelson Books. Captivating is read by John and Stacy Eldridge with a special introduction by the authors.
Introduction. Now we are on holy ground. Writing a book for men, wild at heart, was a fairly straightforward proposition. Not that men are simpletons, but they are the less complicated of the two genders trying to navigate love and life together. Both men and women know this to be true. The mystery of the feminine heart was meant to be a good thing, by the way, a source of joy. Yet it has become a source of shame. Women almost universally feel that they are too much and, at the same time, not what they should be. And men tend to pull away from the deeper waters of a woman's soul, unsure of what they will find there or how to handle it. And so we have missed the treasure that is the heart of a woman, missed the richness femininity was meant to bring to our lives, missed the way it speaks to us of the heart of God.
Rest assured, this is not a book about all the things you are failing to do as a woman. We're tired of those books. As a new Christian, the first book I picked up to read on godly femininity, I threw across the room. I never picked it up again. In the 25 years since, I've only read a few I could wholeheartedly recommend. The rest drive me crazy. Their messages to women make me feel as though you are not the woman you ought to be, but if you do the following 10 things, you can make the grade. They are, by and large, soul-killing. But femininity cannot be prescribed in a formula. We have women friends who love tea parties in China and friends who break out in hives at the thought of them. We have women friends who love to hunt, bow hunt even. Women who love to entertain and women who don't. Women who are professors, moms, doctors, nurses, missionaries, dentists, homemakers, therapists, chefs, artists, poets, rock climbers, triathletes, secretaries, salespeople, and social workers. Beautiful women all. So, is a true woman Cinderella or Joan of Arc? Mary Magdalene or Oprah? How do we recover essential femininity without falling into stereotypes, or worse, ushering in more pressure and shame upon our readers? That is the last thing a woman needs. And yet, there is an essence that God has given to every woman. We share something deep and true down in our hearts. So we venture into this exploration of femininity by way of the heart. What is at the core of a woman's heart? What are her desires? What do we long for as little girls? What do we still long for as women? And how does a woman begin to be healed from the wounds and tragedies of her life?
Sometime between the dreams of your youth and yesterday, something precious has been lost, and that treasure is your heart, your priceless feminine heart. God has set within you a femininity that is powerful and tender, fierce and alluring. No doubt it has been misunderstood. Surely it has been assaulted, but it is there, your true heart, and it is worth recovering. You are captivating.
So we invite you to take a journey with us, a journey of discovery and healing. For your heart is the prize of God's kingdom, and Jesus has come to win you back for himself, all of you. We pray that God will use this book in your life, in your heart, to bring healing, restoration, joy, and life. And if God does that, it will be cause for a wonderful celebration with teacups and china, or paper plates, whatever. One day we will all celebrate together in anticipation and hope. May this little book draw you closer to God's heart and your own. Chapter 1, The Heart of a Woman. Let's do it. Dusk was settling in. The air was cool, fragrant with pine and sage, and the swiftly moving river beckoned. We were camping in the Tetons, and it so happened that our canoe was on top of the car. Let's put in. John looked at me as if I had lost my mind. In less than 20 minutes, night would be upon us and the river and the woods. All would be pitch black. We'd be on the river, alone, with only a general idea of which way to go, down, where to take out, head for the road, and a long walk back to the car. Who knew what dangers lay out there? He looked at me again. looked at our young sons, and then said, "Okay." We sprang into action. The evening was stunning. The river's graceful movements caused the water's colors to shift from cobalt to silver to black. No other person was in sight. We had Oxbow Bend to ourselves. In record time, we had the canoe in the river, life vest securely fastened, paddles at the ready, buoys installed, and off we went, a race to drink as deeply of as much beauty as possible together.
An old wooden bridge hung low across the river. Its broken remains looked as though they would collapse at the next strong breeze. We had to duck to pass underneath. Carefully, we navigated the winding channels of the Snake. I was in back, Stacy in front, our three boys in between, full of wonder and delight. As the stars began to come out, we were like the children present at the creation of Narnia. The sky so clear, the stars so close. We held our breath as one fell slowly, slowly across the sky and disappeared. A beaver slapped the river, the sound like a rifle shot, frightening two ducks into flight, but all we could see between the darkened water and sky were the white ripples of their wake, like synchronized water skiers. Owls began their nightly calls in the woods above, joined by sandhill cranes along the shore. The sounds were familiar, yet otherworldly. We whispered to one another about each new wonder as the paddles dipped almost but not quite silently in and out of the water.
Night fell. Time to take out. We planned to go ashore along a cove closest to the road so we wouldn't have to walk too far to find our car. We didn't dare try to take out where we had put in. That would require paddling against the current with little ability to see where we were going.
As we drifted toward the bank, a bull moose rose from the tall grasses exactly where we had planned to come ashore. He was as dark as the night. We could see him only because he was silhouetted against the sky, jagged mountains behind. He was huge. He was gorgeous. He was in the way, blocking the only exit we had. More people are killed in national parks by moose than any other animal. Remarkable speed, 1,700 pounds of muscle and antlers, and total unpredictability make them dangerous indeed. It would take about 2 seconds for him to hit the water running and capsize our canoe. We could not pass.
The mood changed. John and I were worried now. There was only one alternative to this way out, now closed to us, and that was paddling back upriver in what had become total darkness. Silently, soberly, we turned the canoe and headed up, searching for the right channel that would keep us out of the main current. We hadn't planned on the adventure taking that turn, but suddenly, everything was required. John must steer with skill. I must paddle with strength. One mistake on our part and the strong current would force the canoe broadside, fill it, and sweep our boys off downriver into the night. It was glorious. We did it. He did. I did. We rose to the challenge working together, and the fact that it required all of me, that I was in it with my family and for my family, that I was surrounded by wild, shimmering beauty, and it was, well, kind of dangerous, made the time transcendent. I was no longer Stacy. I was Sacagawea, Indian Princess of the West, a valiant and strong woman.
A woman's journey. Then the time came when the risk it took to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. Anais Nin.
I'm trying to remember when I first knew in my heart that I was no longer a girl but had become a woman. Was it when I graduated from high school or college? Did I know it when I married, when I became a mother? I am 45 years old as I write this, but there remain places in my heart that still feel so very young. As I think back on what would be considered rites of passage in my life, I understand why my journey has felt so unguided, uncertain. The day I started my period, my family embarrassed me at the dinner table by breaking out in song, "This girl is a woman now!" I didn't feel any different. All I felt was mortified that they knew. I stared at my plate, suddenly fascinated by corn. The day I got my first bra, a training bra, the kind with a stretchy material over the front, One of my sisters pulled me into the hallway where, to my horror, my father stood at the ready to take my picture. They said I would laugh about it later. I haven't. Like so many other women, I was left alone to navigate my way through adolescence, through my changing and awakening body, a picture of my changing and awakening heart. No counsel was given for the journey into womanhood. I was encouraged, however, to eat less. My father pulled me aside and told me, "No boy will love you if you're fat." I joined the feminist movement in college, searching, as so many women did in the 70s, for a sense of self. I actually became director of the Women's Resource Center at a liberal state university in California. But no matter how much I asserted my strength and independence as a woman, hear me roar, my heart as a woman remained empty. To be told when you are young and searching that you can be anything is not helpful. It's too vast. It gives no direction. To be told when you are older that you can do anything a man can do isn't helpful either. I didn't want to be a man. What does it mean to be a woman? And as for romance, I stumbled through that mysterious terrain with only movies and music as a guide. Like so many women I know, I struggled alone through the mess of several broken hearts. My last year in college, I fell in love for real, and this young man truly loved me back. John and I dated for 2.5 years and then became engaged. As we made wedding plans, my mother gave me a rare bit of counsel, in this case, her marriage advice. It was twofold. First, love flies out the window when there's no pork chop on the table. And second, always keep your kitchen floor clean. It makes the whole house look better. I caught her drift. Namely, that my new position as wife, centered in the kitchen, making the pork chops and cleaning up after them. I somehow believed that upon saying, "I do," I would be magically transformed into Betty Crocker. I imagined myself baking fresh bread, looking flushed and beautiful as I removed the steaming loaves from the oven. No matter that I hadn't cooked but 5 meals in my entire life, I set about preparing dinners, breakfast even, with determination and zeal. After 2 weeks of this, I lay on the couch despondent, announcing that I didn't know what was for dinner and that John was on his own. Besides, the kitchen floor was dirty. I had failed. My story is like most women's stories. We've received all sorts of messages, but very little help in what it means to become a woman. As one young woman recently wrote us, "I remember when I was 10 asking myself, as well as older females in my life, how a woman of God could actually be confident, scandalous, and beautiful, yet not portray herself as a feminist Nazi or an insecure, I need attention, emotional whore. How can I become a strong woman without becoming harsh? How can I be vulnerable without drowning myself in my sorrow?" There seems to be a growing number of books on the masculine journey, rites of passage, initiations and the like, many of them helpful. But there has been precious little wisdom offered on the path to becoming a woman. Oh, we know the expectations that have been laid upon us by our families, our churches, and our cultures. There are reams of materials on what you ought to do to be a good woman. But that is not the same thing as knowing what the journey towards becoming a woman involves, or even what the goal really should be. The church has not been a big help here. No, that's not quite honest enough. The church has been part of the problem. Its message to women has been primarily, you are here to serve. That's why God created you, to serve. In the nursery, in the kitchen, on the various committees, in your home, in your community. Seriously now. Picture the women we hold up as models of femininity in the church. They are sweet. They are helpful. Their hair is coiffed. They are busy. They are disciplined. They are composed. And they are tired. Think about the women you meet at church. They're trying to live up to some model of femininity. What do they teach you about being a woman? What are they saying to us through their lives? Like we said, you'd have to conclude that a godly woman is tired. And guilty. We're all living in the shadow of that infamous icon, the Proverbs 31 woman, whose life is so busy, I wonder, when does she have time for friendships, for taking walks, or reading good books? Her light never goes out at night? When does she have sex? Somehow, she has sanctified the shame most women live under. Biblical proof that yet again, we don't measure up. Is that supposed to be godly, that sense that you are a failure as a woman?
unseen, unsought, and uncertain.
I know I am not alone in this nagging sense of failing to measure up, a feeling of not being good enough as a woman. Every woman I've ever met feels it. Something deeper than just the sense of failing at what she does, an underlying gut feeling of failing at who she is. I am not enough, and I am too much at the same time. Not pretty enough, not thin enough, not kind enough, not gracious enough, not disciplined enough. But too emotional, too needy, too sensitive, too strong, too opinionated, too messy. The result is shame, the universal companion of women. It haunts us, nipping at our heels, feeding on our deepest fear that we will end up abandoned and alone. After all, if we were better women, whatever that means, life wouldn't be so hard, right? We wouldn't have so many struggles. There would be less sorrow in our hearts. Why is it so hard to create meaningful friendships and sustain them? Why do our days seem so unimportant, filled not with romance and adventure, but with duties and demands? We feel unseen, even by those who are closest to us. We feel unsought, that no one has the passion or the courage to pursue us, to get past our messiness, to find the woman deep inside. And we feel uncertain. Uncertain what it even means to be a woman. Uncertain what it truly means to be feminine. Uncertain if we are, or ever will be. Aware of our deep failings, we pour contempt on our own hearts for wanting more. Oh, we long for intimacy and for adventure. We long to be the beauty of some great story. But the desires set deep in our hearts seem like a luxury, granted only to those women who get their acts together. The message to the rest of us, whether from a driven culture or a driven church, is try harder.
The heart of a woman.
And in all the exhortations, we have missed the most important thing of all. We have missed the heart of a woman. And that is not a wise thing to do. For as the scriptures tell us, the heart is central. Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Proverbs 4:23. Above all else. Why? Because God knows that our heart is core to who we are. It is the source of all our creativity, our courage, and our convictions. It is the fountainhead of our faith, our hope, and of course, our love. This wellspring of life within us is the very essence of our existence, the center of our being. Your heart, as a woman, is the most important thing about you. Think about it. God created you as a woman. God created man in his own image, male and female, he created them. Genesis 1:27. Whatever it means to bear God's image, you do so as a woman, female. That's how and where you bear his image. Your feminine heart has been created with the greatest of all possible dignities, as a reflection of God's own heart. You are a woman to your soul, to the very core of your being. And so the journey to discover what God meant when he created woman in his image, when he created you as his woman, that journey begins with your heart. Another way of saying this is that the journey begins with desire. Look at the games that little girls play, and if you can, remember what you dreamed of as a little girl. Look at the movies women love. Listen to your own heart and the hearts of the women you know. What is it that a woman wants? What does she dream of? Think again of women like Tamar, Ruth, Rahab, not very churchy women, but women held up for esteem in the Bible. We think you'll find that every woman in her heart of hearts longs for three things: to be romanced, to play an irreplaceable role in a great adventure, and to unveil beauty. That's what makes a woman come alive.
To be romanced. I will find you, no matter how long it takes, no matter how far, I will find you. Nathaniel to Korah in The Last of the Mohicans.
One of my favorite games growing up was Kidnapped and Rescued. I know many little girls who played this or wish they had. To be the beauty, abducted by the bad guys, fought for and rescued by a hero. Some version of this has a place in all our dreams. Like Sleeping Beauty, like Cinderella, like Maid Marian, or like Cora in Last of the Mohicans, I wanted to be the heroine and have my hero come for me. Why am I embarrassed to tell you this? I simply loved feeling wanted and fought for. This desire is set deep in the heart of every little girl and every woman. Yet most of us are ashamed of it. We downplay it. We pretend that it is less than it is. We are women of the 21st century, after all, strong, independent, and capable, thank you very much. Uh-huh. And who is buying all those romance novels? Think about the movies you once loved and the movies you love now. Is there a movie for little girls that doesn't have a handsome prince coming to rescue his beloved? Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, The Little Mermaid. A little girl longs for romance, to be seen and desired, to be sought after and fought for. So the Beast must win Beauty's heart in Beauty and the Beast. So in the gazebo scene in The Sound of Music, the captain finally declares his love to Maria by moonlight and song, and then a kiss, and we sigh. Isn't something stirred in you when Edward finally returns at the end of Sense and Sensibility to proclaim his love for Eleanor? Then you're not married? She asks, nearly holding her breath. No, he says. My heart is, and always will be, yours. Or how about when Friedrich returns for Joe at the end of Little Women, or the sunset scene at the bow of the Titanic? And we can't forget Braveheart, how William Wallace pursued Muron with flowers and notes and invitations to ride. She is captured by his love, riding off bareback with him in the rain. Come now, wouldn't you want to ride through the Scottish Highlands with a man like Mel Gibson? When John and I began to date, I had just come out of a 3-year relationship that left me wounded, defensive, and gun-shy. John and I had been friends for many years, but we never seemed to connect in the romance department. I would like him, and he would want to remain just friends. He would feel more for me, and I would not for him. You get the picture. Until one autumn, after he had become a Christian and I was desperately seeking, our spiritual journeys and the desires of our hearts finally met. John wrote me letters, lots of letters, each one filled with his love for God and his passion for me, his desire for me. He spent hours carving a beautiful heart out of manzanita wood, then attached it to a delicate chain and surprised me with it. I still cherish the necklace. I came out to my car after my waitressing shift ended to find his poetry underneath my windshield. Verses written for me, to me. He loved me. He saw me and knew me and pursued me. I loved being romanced. When we are young, we want to be precious to someone, especially Daddy. As we grow older, the desire matures into a longing to be pursued, desired, wanted as a woman. Why am I so embarrassed by the depth of my desire for this? Asked a young friend just the other day. We were talking about her life as a single woman and how she loves her work but would much rather be married. I don't want to hang my life on it, but still, I yearn. Of course, you're a woman. Now, being romanced isn't all that a woman wants, and John and I are certainly not saying that a woman ought to derive the meaning of her existence from whether she is being or has been romanced by a man or not. But don't you see that you want this? To be desired? To be pursued by one who loves you, to be someone's priority? Most of our addictions as women flare up when we feel that we are not loved or sought after. At some core place, maybe deep within, perhaps hidden or buried in her heart, every woman wants to be seen, wanted, and pursued. We want to be romanced.
An irreplaceable role in a great adventure.
When I was a little girl, I used to love World War II movies. I imagined myself being in them. I dreamed of growing up, braiding my hair, and then tucking it up under my helmet. I planned to disguise my gender so that I could join in. I sensed that the men in these movies were part of something heroic, valiant, and worthy. I long to be a part of it too. In the depths of my soul, I long to be a part of something large and good, something that required all of me, something dangerous and worth dying for. There is something fierce in the heart of a woman. Simply insult her children, her man, or her best friend, and you'll get a taste of it. A woman is a warrior too. But she is meant to be a warrior in a uniquely feminine way. Sometime before the sorrows of life did their best to kill it in us, most young women wanted to be a part of something grand, something important. Before doubt and accusation take hold, most little girls sense that they have a vital role to play. They want to believe there is something in them that is needed, and needed desperately. Think of Sarah from Sarah Plain and Tall. A man and his young children need her. Their world is not right until she becomes a part of it. She brings her courage and her creativity to the West and helps to tame it. We are awed by the nurses in Pearl Harbor, how in the midst of a horrifying assault, they bring their courage and strength to rescue the lives of hundreds of men. The women in the Lord of the Rings trilogy are valiant and beautiful. Women like Arwen, Galadriel, and Eowyn change the fate of Middle-earth. And what about women like Esther and Mary and Ruth? They were biblical characters who had irreplaceable roles in a great story. Not safe and nice women, not merely sweet, but passionate and powerful women who were beautiful as warriors. Why do I love remembering the story of canoeing in the dark beauty of the Teton so much? Because I was needed. I was needed. Not only was I needed, but like Arwen, I was irreplaceable. No one else in that canoe could have done what I did. Women love adventures of all sorts. Whether it be the adventure of horses, most girls go through a horse stage, or whitewater rafting, going to a foreign country, performing on stage, having children, starting a business, or diving ever more deeply into the heart of God. We were made to be part of a great adventure, an adventure that is shared. We do not want the adventure merely for the adventure's sake, but for what it requires of us for others. We don't want to be in it alone. We want to be in it with others. Sometimes the idea of living as a hermit appeals to all of us. No demands, no needs, no pain, no disappointments. But that is because we have been hurt, are worn out. In our heart of hearts, that place where we are most ourselves, we don't want to run away for very long. Our lives are meant to be lived with others. As echoes of the Trinity, we remember something. Made in the image of a perfect relationship, we are relational to the core of our beings and filled with a desire for transcendent purpose. We long to be an irreplaceable part of a shared adventure.
Beauty to unveil. The king is enthralled by your beauty. Psalm 45:11.
Lovely little 6-year-old Lacey was visiting our ministry outpost the other day, going from office to office, swinging on the door frame and asking with a smile, "Would you like to hear my song?" Her face, kissed by the sun with charming freckles, two front teeth missing, and eyes dancing with merriment, who could refuse her? She didn't really care if she was an interruption. I doubt the thought crossed her mind. She sang her newly made-up song about puppies and kitties, fully expecting to be delighted in, then skipped down the hall to grace the occupant of the next office. She was like a ray of summer sun, or better, a garden fairy, flitting from office to office. She was a little girl in her glory, unashamed in her desire to delight and be delighted in. It's why little girls play dress-up. Little boys play dress-up too, but in a different way. Our sons were cowboys for years, or army men, or Jedi knights, but they never once dressed up as bridegrooms, fairies, or butterflies. Little boys did not paint their toenails. They don't beg to get their ears pierced. Well, some teenage boys do, but that's another story. Little boys don't play dress up with mommy's jewelry and high heels. They don't sit for hours and brush each other's hair. Remember twirling skirts? Most little girls go through a season where they will not wear anything if it does not twirl. And if it sparkles, so much the better. Hours and hours of endless play result from giving little girls a box filled with hats, scarves, necklaces, and clothes. Dime store beads are priceless jewels. Hand-me-down pumps are glass slippers. Grandma's nightie, a ballroom gown. Once dressed, they dance around the house or preen in front of a mirror. Their young hearts intuitively want to know they are lovely. Some will ask with words, "Am I lovely?" Others will simply ask with their eyes. Verbal or not, whether wearing a shimmery dress or covered in mud, all little girls want to know. As a young songwriter recently wrote, "I want to be beautiful and make you stand in awe. Look inside my heart and be amazed. I want to hear you say, 'Who I am is quite enough.' I just want to be worthy of love and beautiful." Bethany Dillon, Beautiful. Last summer, John and I attended a ball at the beautiful historic Broadmoor Hotel. It was a stunning affair. Black tie, candlelight, dinner, dancing, you name it. The courtyard where the hors d'oeuvres were served was filled with fresh flowers, flowing fountains, and the music of a gifted pianist. It was an evening long planned for. For weeks, no, months ahead of the affair, I, like every other woman who attended, asked the all-important question, "What will I wear?" As the special night drew closer, I also wondered if it was possible to lose 20 pounds in 7 days. The evening turned out to be glorious. The weather was perfect, every detail attended to and lovely. But the highlight by far was the women. Above the sound of the splashing water from the fountains, even above the music that floated through the air, was the sound of delighted exclamations. "You look beautiful! You are gorgeous! What an amazing dress! How lovely you are!" We were delighting in each other's beauty and enjoying our own. We were playing dress up for real and loving it. These women were normal women, women just like you and me. Women you would run into at the bank or the grocery store or the office. Women whose battles against acne have left their faces marked and their souls scarred. Women whose struggle with their weight has been the bane of their lives. Women who always felt their hair was too thin, too thick, too straight, or too curly. Ordinary women, if there is such a thing. But women who, at least for a few hours this night, took the risk of revealing their beauty. Perhaps better, whose beauty was unveiled. Think of your wedding day, or the wedding day you dream of. How important is your dress as a bride? Would you just grab the first thing in your closet, throw on any old thing? A friend of ours is getting married in 6 months. Now this young woman has seen her share of boys and heartbreaks. Her tale of beauty has many hurts to it. But as she told us about trying on wedding dresses and finding just the right dress, the weariness faded away, and she was radiant. "I felt like a princess," she said, almost shyly. "Isn't that what you dreamed of?" One little girl who is being raised in a home where her feminine heart is welcomed told her mother about a wonderful dream she had. "My daughter Emma, nearly 6 years old, came to me all aglow this morning. She lay at my feet on my bed all stretched out as if she hadn't a care in the world. 'Mommy,' she said, 'I had a wonderful dream last night.' 'What was it about?' I asked. 'I was a queen,' she answered. And as she did, her cheeks blushed pink. 'Really?' I replied. 'What happened in your dream?' 'I was wearing a long, beautiful dress,' she said with hands gesturing downward, flowing. 'Was there anything on your head?' I wondered aloud. 'Yes, a crown.' 'Why was that such a wonderful dream?' 'I just love feeling that way.' 'What way?' And with a sigh, she spoke one word. Beauty. Emma's dream, as told to her mother. The desire to be beautiful is an ageless longing. My friend Lily is in her mid-80s. As she descended the stairs of her home one Christmas season, I was captured by her beauty. She was wearing a green corduroy jumper with a white turtleneck that had little candy canes all over it. I said, "Lily, you look lovely." Her face lit up, wrinkles and age spots disappearing as she put her hands out at her sides like a ballerina and did a delightful little twirl. She was no longer 80. She was ageless. God has set eternity in our hearts. The longing to be beautiful is set there as well. Now, we know that the desire to be beautiful has caused many women untold grief. How many diets have you been on? Countless tears have been shed and hearts broken in its pursuit. As Janice Ian sang, "I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear-skinned smiles." Beauty has been extolled and worshipped and kept just out of reach for most of us. Do you like having your picture taken? Do you like seeing those pictures later? How do you feel when people ask your age? This issue of beauty runs deep. For others, beauty has been shamed, used, and abused. Some of you have learned that possessing beauty can be dangerous. And yet, and this is just astounding, in spite of all the pain and distress that beauty has caused us as women, the desire remains. During the midst of a talk I gave on the heart of a woman last year, one of the women in the audience leaned over to a friend and said, "I don't know what this whole thing is about, this twirling skirts and all." The words had barely left her mouth when she burst into tears and had to leave the room. Little did she know how deep the desire ran and how much pain it had caused. Many of us have hardened our hearts to this desire, the desire to be the beauty. We too have been hurt so deeply in this area that we no longer identify with, perhaps even resent, the longing. But it's there. And it's not just the desire for an outward beauty, but more, a desire to be captivating in the depths of who you are. Cinderella is beautiful, yes, but she is also good. Her outward beauty would be hollow were it not for the beauty of her heart. That's why we love her. In The Sound of Music, the Countess has Maria beat in the looks department, and they both know it. But Maria has a rare and beautiful depth of spirit. She has the capacity to love snowflakes on kittens and mean-spirited children. She sees the handiwork of God in music and laughter and climbing trees. Her soul is alive, and we are drawn to her. Ruth may have been a lovely, strong woman, but it is to her unrelenting courage and vulnerability and faith in God that Boaz is drawn. Esther is the most beautiful woman in the land, but it's her bravery and her good heart that moves the king to spare her people. This isn't about dresses and makeup. Beauty is so important that we'll come back to it again and again in this book. For now, don't you recognize that a woman yearns to be seen and to be thought of as captivating? We desire to possess a beauty that is worth pursuing, worth fighting for, a beauty that is core to who we really are. We want beauty that can be seen, beauty that can be felt, beauty that affects others, a beauty all our own to unveil.
The heart of a man. As I described in Wild at Heart, there are three core desires in the heart of every man as well. If you haven't read that book, you really should. It will open your eyes into the world of men. But they are uniquely masculine desires. For starters, every man wants a battle to fight. It's the whole thing with boys and weapons. Over the years, our house has become an arsenal. Pirate swords, Indian knives, lightsabers, six-shooters, paintball markers, airsoft guns. That name had to have been invented for moms. You name it. Our boys wrestled and hit and slammed one another up against the walls, and that is how they show affection. And look at the movies men love. Braveheart, Gladiator, Top Gun, High Noon, Saving Private Ryan. Men are made for battle. And ladies, don't you love the heroes of those movies? You might not want to fight in a war, but don't you long for a man who will fight for you? To have Daniel Day-Lewis look you in the eyes and say, "No matter how long it takes, no matter how far, I will find you." Women don't fear a man's strength if he is a good man. In fact, passivity might make a man safe, but it has done untold damage to women in the long run. It certainly did to Eve. More on that later. Men also long for adventure. Boys love to climb and jump and see how fast they can ride their bikes with no hands. Just look in your garage. All the gear and go-karts and motorcycles and ropes and boats and stuff. This isn't about boys and their toys. Adventure is a deeply spiritual longing written in the hearts of every man. Adventure requires something of us, puts us to the test. And though we may fear the test, at the same time we yearn to be tested, to discover that we have what it takes. Finally, every man longs for a beauty to rescue. He really does. Where would Robin Hood be without Marian, or King Arthur without Guinevere? Lonely men fighting lonely battles. You see, it's not just that a man needs a battle to fight. He needs someone to fight for. There is nothing that inspires a man to courage so much as the woman he loves. Most of the daring and, okay, sometimes ridiculous things young men do are to impress the girls. Men go to war carrying photos of their sweethearts in their wallets. This is a metaphor of this deeper longing to fight for the beauty. This is not to say that a woman is a helpless creature who can't live her life without a man. I'm saying that men long to offer their strength on behalf of a woman. Now, can you see how the desires of a man's heart and the desires of a woman's heart were at least meant to fit beautifully together? A woman in the presence of a good man, a real man, loves being a woman. His strength allows her feminine heart to flourish. His pursuit draws out her beauty. And a man in the presence of a real woman loves being a man. Her beauty arouses him to play the man. It draws out his strength. She inspires him to be a hero. Would that we all were so fortunate.
By way of the heart.
The longings God has written deep in your heart are telling you something essential about what it means to be a woman and the life He meant for you to live. Now we know many of those desires have gone unmet or been assaulted or simply so long neglected that most women end up living two lives. On the surface, they are busy and efficient, professional even. They are getting by. And on the inside, women lose themselves in a fantasy world or in cheap novels, or they give themselves over to food or some other addiction to numb the ache of their hearts. But your heart is still there, crying out to be set free, to find the life your desires tell you of.
You can find that life if you are willing to embark on a great adventure. That is what we are inviting you to. Not to learn one more set of standards you failed to meet, not towards a new set of rules to live by and things you ought to do, something far, far better, a journey of the heart, a journey towards the restoration and release of the woman you always longed to be. This book is not about what you ought to do or who you ought to be. It's about discovering who you already are as a woman. A woman who at her core was made for romance, made to play an irreplaceable role in a shared adventure, and who really does possess a beauty all her own to unveil. The woman God had in mind when He made Eve, and when He made you. Glorious, powerful, and captivating.
Chapter 2, What Eve Alone Can Tell. My parents named me after Saint Anastasia, a woman martyred for her faith in the 5th century, so that every week during Mass, my name would be read aloud when certain saints were commemorated. That's why Stacy is spelled so weirdly. Take off the Anna at the beginning and the at the end, and Stacy is what you get. I love it. And there's a deeper reason. I learned about Anastasia while in elementary school. Not Saint Anastasia, but a princess. The youngest daughter of the last Tsar of Russia, Anastasia was rumored to have escaped the assassins who murdered the rest of her family. She was a young girl when her family was executed, and it was said that she was still alive, somewhere out there in the world, incognito, a true princess in disguise. Women claimed to be her. One woman in particular was nearly convincing. Still, Anastasia remained a mystery, a princess lost into this world, hidden but true. I was intrigued and enamored by Princess Anastasia. I began to read everything I could get my hands on about Russian history, For a reason I could not explain, I felt a kinship with this mysterious princess, a connection to her. I wasn't pretending I was her, but still, something deep in my heart whispered that I, too, was more than met the eye. Perhaps I, too, was a part of royalty, but my position had been lost. Perhaps I, too, was in disguise. My heart quickened at the thought of being a woman who was once a true princess. I don't think I'm alone in this. Have you ever wondered why the Cinderella story keeps haunting us? Not only is it a perennial favorite of little girls, women love it, too. Think of all the movies made along its themes, movies like Pretty Woman and Ever After, and A Cinderella Story, Made in Manhattan. Why is this notion of a hidden princess and a prince who comes to find her so enduring? Is there something in our hearts that is trying to speak to us? Is it just fantasy, escapism, or is there something more? The desire of a woman's heart and the realities of a woman's life seem an ocean apart. Oh, we long for romance and an irreplaceable role in a great story. We long for beauty. But that's not the life we have. The result is a sense of shame. Having listened to the hearts of women for many, many years, both in the context of friendship and in the counseling office, we are struck by how deeply and universally women struggle with their self-worth. "I feel like a household appliance," one woman confessed to us. Now, this is not to say that men don't also wrestle with their sense of worth, but there is something deeper to this struggle for women, and far more universal. And there are reasons for it, reasons unique to Eve and her daughters.
We're reminded of Pascal's metaphor that our unmet longings and unrequited desires are, in fact, the miseries of a dethroned monarch. Mankind is like a king or queen in exile, and we cannot be happy until we have recovered our true state. What would you expect the queen of a kingdom or the beauty of a realm to feel when she wakes to find herself a laundress in a foreign land? A woman's struggle with her sense of worth points to something glorious she was designed to be. That great emptiness they feel points to the great place they were created for. It's true. All those legends and fairy tales of the undiscovered princess and the beauty hidden as a maid are more accurate than we thought. There's a reason little girls resonate with them so. Rather than asking, what should a woman do? What is her role? It would be far more helpful to ask, what is a woman? What is her design? And why did God place woman in our midst? We must go back to her beginnings, to the story of Eve. Even though we might have heard the story before, we have certainly told it many times ourselves, it bears repeating. We clearly haven't learned its lessons. For if we had, men would treat women much, much differently, and women would view themselves in a far better light. So let us start there, with light, with the dawn of the world.
The crown of creation. To understand the creation story, you must think of a work of art. Think of the Sistine Chapel, or the Venus de Milo, or Beethoven's Fifth, or of Sarah Brightman and Andre Bocelli singing Time to Say Goodbye. Creation itself is a great work of art, and all works after it are echoes of the original. How it unfolded and where it reached its climax are mysteries worth unveiling. We will never truly understand women until we understand this. The scene begins in darkness.
Darkness over the deep and God's breath hovering over the waters. Genesis 1:2.
The breathless moment in the dark before the first notes of a great symphony or concert, a play, or an epic film. All is formless, empty, dark. Then a voice speaks.
Let there be light.
And suddenly there is light, pure light, magnificent light. Its radiance will enable us to see now what is unfolding. The voice speaks again and again.
Let there be a vault in the midst of the waters, and let it divide water from water. Let the waters under the heavens be gathered in one place, so that the dry land will appear.
Creation in its early stages begins like any great work of art, with uncut stone or a mass of clay, a rough sketch, a blank sheet of music, formless and empty, as Genesis 1:2 has it. Then God begins to fashion the raw materials he has made, like an artist working with the stone or sketch or page before him. Light and dark, heaven and earth, land and sea, it's beginning to take shape. With passion and brilliance, the Creator works in large, sweeping movements on a grand scale. Great realms are distinguished from one another and established. Then he moves back over them again for a second pass, as he begins to fill in color, detail, finer lines.
Let the earth grow grass, plants, and trees bearing fruit. Let there be lights in the vaults of the heavens. Let the waters swarm with the swarm of living creatures, and let fowl fly over the earth. Forest and meadow burst forth, tulips and pine trees and moss-covered stones. And notice, the masterpiece is becoming more intricate, more intimate. He fills the night sky with 1,000,000,000 stars, and he names them, sets them in constellations. Into our world, God opens his hand, and the animals spring forth. Myriads of birds in every shape and size and song take wing. Hawks, herons, pelicans. All the creatures of the sea leap into it. Whales, dolphins, fish of 1,000 colors and designs. Horses, gazelles, buffalo thunder across the plains, running like the wind. It is more astonishing than we could possibly imagine. From water and stone, to pomegranate and rose, to leopard and nightingale, creation ascends in beauty. The plot is thickening. The symphony is building and swelling higher and higher to a crescendo. No wonder the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. As Job said, a great hurrah goes up from the heavens. The greatest of all masterpieces is emerging. What was once formless and empty is now overflowing with life and color and sound and movement in 1,000 variations. Most importantly, notice that each creature is more intricate and noble and mysterious than the last. A cricket is amazing, but it cannot compare to a wild horse. Then something truly astonishing takes place. God sets his own image on the earth. He creates a being like himself. He creates a son. The Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. Genesis 2:7. It is nearing the end of the sixth day, the end of the Creator's great labor, as Adam steps forth, the image of God, the triumph of his work. He alone is pronounced the Son of God. Nothing in creation even comes close. Picture Michelangelo's David. He is magnificent. Truly, the masterpiece seems complete. And yet, the master says that something is not good. Something is missing. And that something is Eve. And the Lord God cast a deep slumber on the human, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed over the flesh where it had been, and the Lord God built the rib he had taken from the human into a woman, and he brought her to the man.
She is the crescendo, the final, astonishing work of God, woman. In one last flourish, creation comes to a finish, not with Adam, but with Eve. She is the master's finishing touch. How we wish this were an illustrated book and we could show you now some painting or sculpture that captures this, like the stunning Greek sculpture of the goddess Nike of Samothrace, the winged beauty, just alighting on the prow of a great ship, her beautiful form revealed through the thin veils which sweep around her. Eve is breathtaking. Given the way creation unfolds, how it builds to ever higher and higher works of art, can there be any doubt that Eve is the crown of creation? Not an afterthought, not a nice addition like an ornament on a tree. She is God's final touch, his piece de resistance. She fills a place in the world nothing and no one else can fill. Step to a window, ladies, if you can. Better still, find some place with a view. Look out across the earth and say to yourselves, the whole vast world is incomplete without me. Creation reached its zenith in me. What does Eve speak to us?
The story of Eve holds such rich treasures for us to discover. The essence and purpose of a woman is unveiled here in the story of her creation. These profound, eternal, mythic themes are written not just here in the coming of Eve, but in the soul of every woman after. Woman is the crown of creation, the most intricate, dazzling creature on earth. She has a crucial role to play, a destiny all her own. And she, too, bears the image of God, but in a way that only the feminine can speak. What can we learn from her? God wanted to reveal something about himself, so he gave us Eve. When you are with a woman, ask yourself, what is she telling me about God? It will open up wonders for you. First, you'll discover that God is relational to his core and that he has a heart for romance. Second, that he longs to share adventures with us, adventures you cannot accomplish without him. And finally, that God has a beauty to unveil, a beauty that is captivating and powerfully redemptive.
Romance and relationships, the answer to loneliness. Man's love is of man's life a thing apart, 'tis a woman's whole existence. Byron.
Eve is created because things were not right without her. Something was not good. It is not good for the man to be alone, Genesis 2:18. This just staggers us. Think of it. The world is young and completely unstained. Adam is yet in his innocence and full of glory. He walks with God. Nothing stands between them. They share something none of us has ever known, only longed for, an unbroken friendship, untouched by sin. Yet something is not good? Something is missing? What could it possibly be? Eve? Woman? Femininity? Whoa, talk about significance. To be specific, what was not good was the fact that the man was alone. It is not good for the human to be alone. I shall make him a sustainer beside him, Genesis 2:18. How true this is. Whatever else we know about women, we know they are relational creatures to their core. While little boys are killing one another in mock battles on the playground, little girls are negotiating relationships. If you want to know how people are doing, what's going on in our world, don't ask me. Ask Stacy. I don't call friends and chat with them for an hour on the phone. I can't tell you who's dating whom, whose feelings have been hurt. Ask Stacy.
This is so second nature, so assumed among women, it goes unnoticed by us. We care more about relationships than just about anything else. Radio talk show host Dennis Prager reports that when the topic of the day on his show is a macro issue like politics or finance, his callers will be Ed, Jack, Bill, and Dave. But when the topic is a micro issue involving human relationships, issues like dating or faithfulness or children, his callers will be Jane, Joanne, Susan, and Karen.
We were at a neighborhood Christmas party this past December. It's an annual thing, the only time the neighbors on our street get together. The men pretty quickly became a huddle in the kitchen near the potato chips, engaged in a passionate debate about concrete. I kid you not. That was the topic of the evening, concrete driveways. Meanwhile, the women were in the living room talking about sex after menopause.
Most women define themselves in terms of their relationships and the quality they deem those relationships to have. I am a mother, a sister, a daughter, a friend, or I am alone. I'm not seeing anyone right now, or my children aren't calling, or my friends seem distant. This is not a weakness in women. It is a glory that reflects the heart of God.
God's heart for relationship.
The vast desire and capacity a woman has for intimate relationships tells us of God's vast desire and capacity for intimate relationships. In fact, this may be the most important thing we ever learn about God, that He yearns for relationship with us.
Now this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God. John 17:3.
The whole story of the Bible is a love story between God and His people. He yearns for us. He cares. He has a tender heart. But Zion said, "The Lord has forsaken me. The Lord has forgotten me." Can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion on the child she has born? Though she may forget, I will not forget you, declares the Lord, Isaiah 49:14-15.
I will give them a heart to know me, that I am the Lord. They will be my people, and I will be their God, for they will return to me with all their heart. Jeremiah 24:7.
Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Matthew 23:37.
What a comfort to know that this universe we live in is relational at its core, that our God is a tender-hearted God who yearns for relationship with us. If you have any doubt about that, simply look at the message He sent us in woman. Amazing. Not only does God long for us, but He longs to be loved by us. How have we missed this? How many of you see God as longing to be loved by you? We see Him as strong and powerful, but not as needing us, vulnerable to us, yearning to be desired. But as I wrote in Wild at Heart, after years of listening to the heart cry of women, I am convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt of this. God wants to be loved. He wants to be a priority to someone. How could we have missed this? From cover to cover, from beginning to end, the cry of God's heart is, "Why won't you choose me?" It's amazing to me how humble, how vulnerable God is on this point. "You will find me," says the Lord, "when you seek me with all your heart." Jeremiah 29:13. In other words, look for me, pursue me. I want you to pursue me. Amazing. As Tozer said, "God waits to be wanted." Can there be any doubt that God wants to be sought after? The first and greatest of all commands is to love Him. He wants us to love Him, to seek Him with all our heart. A woman longs to be sought after too, with the whole heart of her pursuer. God longs to be desired just as a woman longs to be desired. This is not some weakness or insecurity on the part of a woman, that deep yearning to be desired. "Take me for longing," as Alison Krauss sang, "or leave me behind." God feels the same way. Remember the story of Martha and Mary? Mary chose God, and Jesus said that is what He wanted. Mary has chosen what is better, Luke 10:42. She chose me.
Life changes dramatically when romance comes into our lives. Christianity changes dramatically when we discover that it, too, is a great romance, that God yearns to share a life of beauty, intimacy, and adventure with us. "I have loved you with an everlasting love," Jeremiah 31:3. This whole world was made for romance. The rivers and the glens, the meadows and beaches, flowers, music, a kiss. But we have a way of forgetting all that, losing ourselves in work and worry. Eve, God's message to the world in feminine form, invites us to romance. Through her, God makes romance a priority of the universe. So God endows woman with certain qualities which are essential to relationship, qualities that speak of God. She is inviting. She is vulnerable. She is tender. She embodies mercy. She is also fierce and fiercely devoted. As the old saying goes, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." That's just how God acts when He isn't chosen. "I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God who will not share your affection with any other God." Exodus 20:5. A woman's righteous jealousy speaks of the jealousy of God for us. tender and inviting, intimate and alluring, fiercely devoted. Oh yes, our God has a passionate, romantic heart. Just look at Eve.
To continue, please insert the next CD.